Okay, so welcome everyone to a new episode of the Quantum Gravity Seminar. And today we have the pleasure to have Subra Rajou from the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research. And he accepted to give it a talk despite the late time where he's in India. So thank you for that. And he's gonna tell us about holography information from semi-classical gravity. So without any further ado, let Subra take the stage.
So thank you very much, first of all, Daniele, for inviting me. And thank you very much, all of you who've come to listen. I know this is also an unusual time for you, so thanks very much for coming at that time. So before I start my talk, I'd just like to start by giving you the collaborators. And this is going to be based on work which I did with Chandramouli, Olga, Alok, Siddharth, and Kiriakos, Shovik, and Jan William Bryan. So these references might be useful if you decide to follow up on what I'm going to say. So before I start, let me just try and give you what I think is the main message of the talk, what I think is one takeaway that I think is relevant in this talk. And the main message in this talk that I'm going to try and convey is the following. I'm going to try and argue to you over the next hour or so that quantum gravity has a very unusual property, which is very unlike any local quantum field theory. And the property is that if you take a Cauchy slice in general in a quantum field theory, we think that we can specify data independently on different parts of the Cauchy slice. So, you think you could put an excitation in the middle here without affecting the wave function far away. And I'm going to try and argue that in quantum gravity, that's not the case. And in fact, a copy of all the information on the Cauchy slice is available near the boundary of this slice, which is this region that's shaded in blue. So this is the broad picture, but I'm going to try and make this more precise, first in anti-de Sitter space, in global anti-de Sitter space, where you see this being a picture of global anti-de Sitter space, and this is a Cauchy slice. And I'm going to try and argue that all the information on this slice is available in this brown ring that's near the boundary of ADS. And I'll also try and explain why this is not just some abstract result, but very concretely, if there are observers who live in this brown annular region, they can, using a very physical protocol, obtain information about the interior of the slice. I'm also going to try and describe how these results work in four-dimensional flat spacetimes. And there, the claim is going to be, the precise version of this claim I mentioned is going to be, that all the information that's available on null infinity is in fact also available on the boundary of null infinity. So in particular, all the information on future null infinity, which is this region on top, is available on its past boundary, and all the information on past null infinity is available on its future boundary, which is marked in orange here. So that's going to be the other result I'm going to try and establish. When applied to black holes, this leads to a rather interesting perspective. It suggests that the exterior region, if you take a black hole, it suggests that this exterior region, which is this region here, always retains with it a complete copy of what fell into the black hole and what's happening in the black hole interior. And this therefore leads to what I think is a fresh perspective on the information paradox. So that's roughly the kind of argument I'm going to make. The broad picture of information in a theory of gravity always being available at the edges of the Cauchy slice, and then try and make it more precise in ADS and flat space, and then talk about black holes. So before I go into more detailed arguments, I just wanted to...
Can I ask a question? Sorry, it's long.
Yes, please, yeah.
Unless you don't want questions during your talk.
No, please go ahead.
How much of that is really due to using infinity?
How much of that is going to be due to using infinity as opposed to being somewhere else?
Yeah, just a finite region, because what you were saying would be true for finite regions.
Right? Yeah, in flat space, I'll try and make some statements about how you can get away without being quite at infinity, how information to the future of a cut and null infinity is available on that cut. In general, I would like to believe that morally, something like this should also be true in other, if you weren't, you didn't just look at null infinity, but just try to, take some.
Yeah, a diamond. There. For a diamond, just take a diamond.
Yeah, if you try to take, so what you're saying is, what if you didn't have to go to infinity, but you're allowed to make regions just outside the diamond? I think that something like this should be true, but I'll try and explain why. It's hard to make that precise in a theory of gravity, and that's roughly because, you know, the metric fluctuates and it's hard to make this notion of some operators outside a certain region and inside a region precise unless you go all the way out to infinity. I mean, the precise results I'll establish, as you'll see, will be for infinity, but I would like to believe that the claim is true more generally, but we can discuss more perhaps later.
Yeah, we can discuss more. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, so just a few words about the philosophy of this talk. So as you'll see, you know, the title of this talk is about holography from semi-classical gravity. So I'm actually going to start by considering and pointing out to you some properties of the low energy theory of gravity. And then I'm going to try and describe what are the precise assumptions and the precise extrapolation that one needs to make this claim in the full theory. Then the full theory information is holographic in the sense that I described. So that's going to be the philosophy of my talk throughout, that, you know, I'll make some low energy observations and then try and extrapolate them. So this is based on many previous works and arguments that were made in this direction. Perhaps to this community, the work of Marolf might be the most familiar, but as you'll see, the detailed conclusions and the arguments are somewhat different from previous work. So this is an outline of the rest of my talk. I already gave you the introduction. I'm now going to describe how the story works more precisely in anti-de Sitter space, and then I'll describe how this works in asymptotically flat space times. And as I promised, I'll try and explain why, you know, these are not just abstract results, but lead to a physical protocol for observers who are near the boundary of a Cauchy slice to extract information from the interior. That's going to be section 4, and then I'll conclude with some discussion about black holes. Okay, so let me start by describing ADS. So ADS is this cylinder. This is a picture of ADS. And the first thing I want to do is make this notion of, you know, what do I mean by the information being available near the edges of a Cauchy slice? So on the left-hand side, you see a Cauchy slice in ADS, which is a slice, and then there's this region which is near the boundary. Now, one way to define this region is to define the region as being the region that's outside some large ball of radius R0. But then, you know, you might worry about what happens if you made a big perturbation or threw in a lot of matter or formed a black hole and how, you know, the edges of this region would fluctuate. So in fact, there's a simple way to make this precise, and that is to think about observables that live precisely on the boundary of ADS as R goes to infinity, but that are confined to a small time band. So rather than looking at observables on one Cauchy slice, we look at observables between t equal to 0 and t equal to epsilon, as you see on the right-hand side. But that at r equal to infinity. And morally, this is like looking at observables on this brown annular region where the relationship between r0, which is the edge of this region, and this epsilon is roughly r0 is cot epsilon by 2. In global ADS, that's exact. And in some other space-time, that would not be exact. But that's morally the way you should think about it. But so what I'd really like to show is that if you look at asymptotic observables in this small time band from 0 to epsilon, they contain all the information about the bulk, and that's what I'd like to argue. Okay, so the precise result is going to be that I'm going to try and establish is going to be the following. Let's say we look at this time band that's between 0 to epsilon. I've now made epsilon very small. I've blown it up in the previous figure just for purposes of illustration. I'm going to try and argue that if one looks at observables in this time band, which is marked in red, then if you have two states that are distinct in the bulk, so for instance, the state on the left and the state on the right. The state on the right has some excitation sitting in the middle of anti-de Sitter space. And I'm going to try and argue that if you have two states which are distinct in the bulk, then they can be distinguished by observables in the small red time band that's near the boundary. So that's going to be the result I'm going to try and establish.
Sorry, can I ask you a question?
Yes, please.
How is this different from a standard ADS CFT?
Yeah. So in ADS CFT, of course, we don't talk about a time band, it'll just be a time slice. But what I'm trying to argue here is that the same argument arises by looking at semi-classical properties of the bulk. So what I'm trying to argue is that, you know, if we had just analyzed our bulk quantum gravity carefully, then we would have arrived at the same kind of conclusion that information is holographic in this sense. So in ADS, of course, you know, one reason to believe this result is because we know about ADS CFT. When I go on to flat space, there the result will be new. So in flat space, I'm going to describe how information is localized, and there we don't have an analog of ADS CFT. So you can think of ADS as a warm-up where we are deriving a result that we already know to be true using different techniques, using only semi-classical techniques.
Sorry, can I ask, in fact, if I understand what you're saying? What you're saying is that in ADS CFT, as far as understood, this property is just assumed from the get-go, whereas you're trying to get some evidence or prove it.
I'm trying to prove it. The property ADS CFT is usually derived by considering a setup of brains and then trying to take a low energy limit. So there's
it's not proven from the point of view of gravity or quantum gravity. So it's from that point of view, you have to believe it. It's not.
I agree. I mean, you're right that I'm trying to start from the theory of gravity.
But do you agree in the sense of passively agree or forcefully agree? In the sense, I mean, to us in gravity, this is a key point that ADS safety is a conjecture. It has a lot of evidence, but it's a conjecture. And you are trying to prove it is a very strong statement. So we just want to make sure that we understand.
Fair enough. Maybe because I come from a different bias, which is I think of ADS safety as being very well established. And I think of this as being a strong check, the argument of, you know,
Here you're in a community where people have no idea why people believe in ADS CFT.
If you didn't know ADS CFT, then this would be a derivation of ADS CFT. Why does ADS CFT work from a bulk gravity point?
Yeah. Why is it plausible?
Yeah, if you had to explain to DeWitt or Wheeler why gravity was holographic, then this is the argument one would make. Maybe that's one way to say it. If you could phone back in time and okay. Okay, so let me say a few things about ADS. These are just some simple things just to remind you. So ADS, the reason I started with ADS, of course, apart from the ADS CFT discussion, is that ADS is a simpler setup because it's like a box. And precisely because ADS is like a box at low energies, I'll talk about the high energy spectrum later, but at low energies, you know, one can just get the spectrum just by doing effective field theory in anti-de Sitter space. And one finds that, you know, there's a vacuum, there's a unique vacuum, and then there are some separated excitations about that vacuum. This gap is easy to compute in effective field theory. But all I want to point out is that, you know, because ADS is a box, we have this discrete spectrum at low energies, which has a unique vacuum. Okay, now this is a trivial statement, but there is of course a remarkable property of gravity. And the remarkable property of gravity is that if you put the system in one of these states that I described previously, and you can measure the energy of this state from infinity. So in particular, you know, this is sometimes stated, this is as the fact that the Hamiltonian is a boundary term in gravity, but you could also just think of it as a manifestation of the Gauss law. The fact that if you put an excitation in the interior, like this blue excitation here, it modifies the metric as you go far away, and you can read off the energy of the system or the energy of the state by just integrating the metric near the boundary on this little red slice, on this little red edge here. Now, actually, there's been a lot of discussion about this, and I do not want to assume that this edge remains the Hamiltonian for the full theory. That would be a very strong assumption. But I do want to make a weaker assumption, and the weaker assumption is as follows. In whatever full theory of quantum gravity we have in anti-de Sitter space, whenever we get a full theory of quantum gravity in anti-de Sitter space, the assumption is that I'm going to assume that the vacuum of this operator H coincides with the vacuum of the full theory, and that this operator H remains a positive operator which lives in this boundary algebra that I've defined here. So this is a statement that this operator H coincides with the true Hamiltonian, at least at low energies. So one could say this another way. The statement is that, you know, in quantum gravity, one can't hide energy from the boundary. So if you read off the boundary metric and you find the energy is zero, then you know you're in the vacuum, both in the full theory of quantum gravity and in effective field theory. So that's an assumption I'm going to have to make about the full theory of quantum gravity. This is not the same as the assumption that H is a full Hamiltonian. Your question? Yes, please.
Yeah, could we? So I think that the use of this H is a little bit misleading because, as you say, it's energy.
Yes.
So if I look at the phase space, right?
Yes.
I'm talking about the canonical phase space because you refer to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation essentially. In the canonical phase space, this energy is not the Hamiltonian. Even classically, this is not a differentiable function of the phase space. Because you're not supposed to be on the constrained surface to begin with, right? So its numerical value happens to be this, but when you take the Poisson bracket, numerical value is totally irrelevant because you are taking.
I'm only going to measure this operator, as we'll see later.
But you just assumed. You said that you make an assumption, which is not.
The assumption is that this is this is an operator in the full quantum theory, and that you take the metric and you can integrate it, and that I'm allowed to measure it, and I'll say it in the next slide. and that I'm allowed to use the standard rules of quantum mechanics for this operator. In fact, I will not assume that H is the true Hamiltonian. So this is the line on the bottom of the slide is that I do not want to assume that H is the Hamiltonian of the full theory.
Okay, so
I'm just saying this is a function, this is an operator. It's a well-defined operator in the full theory once I quantize the metric. And you're right, its value gives me the energy. That's all I'm going to need. And if its value is zero, then I know it's in the vacuum. That's really all I'm going to need.
Okay, but I just want to, just one last remark is that
yes,
it's still an assumption that it's a well-defined operator, because what would be the well-defined operator would be the... It would be the volume term and the surface term. The sum together is a well-defined, and that's what we see in the for the diffeomorphism constraint of general relativity, that what is a well-defined operator is the sum of the surface term and the bulk term, not just the surface term by itself in full theory.
Indeed, but there's some constraint which will set the volume term to zero, and so to the extent that the metric is a well-defined operator, I just want to take the boundary value of the metric and read that off. So I really have some fluctuating metric in the bulk, and if that's a good operator in the quantum theory, then I take the boundary value of that metric and I just integrate it.
Okay, and I think we should come back to that at the end, because I think this might be a subtle issue, but I don't want to distract you too much. So thank you.
Sure, yeah, we can come back to that. Yeah. Okay. So we already discussed this, but the main assumption I want to make about this operator H, which is the integrated metric, is that I'm allowed to use the standard rules of quantum mechanics for this observable. So in particular, I'm allowed to make a measurement of this observable by measuring the integrated metric. And when I make a measurement, this observable has some spectrum and there are various values I can get. And the important thing I'm going to need is that I'm allowed to use the standard Born rule. And the Born rule tells me if I measure this observable, there's a certain probability that I'll get zero. If I happen to be in the state G, then the probability that I'll get zero is just given by, you know, the expectation value of the projector on the state zero in the state G. That's just the Born rule. And therefore, this also tells me that this operator, the projector on the vacuum, which is 0, 0, is a boundary observable in a theory of gravity. And this just follows from A, assuming that this operator H gives you the value of the energy. It correctly gives you the value of the energy, at least at low energies. We don't know what happens at very high energies. And that we are allowed to use the standard rules of quantum mechanics. And if so, then you can clearly measure the expectation value of this projector in any state. And therefore, this P0 is an observable in this algebra of boundary of operators. Okay. Now I need to say a little bit more about the Hilbert space. So far, I was talking about low energy states. The second assumption I need to make is that I can formulate the theory in the space that's given by exciting this vacuum that we discussed by boundary operators at arbitrary times. So what that means is, it doesn't have to be a single operator. What that means is I start with the vacuum and then I act on it with asymptotic operators, such as the asymptotic value of the metric or a product of two metrics at various values of time, or the asymptotic value of the metric multiplied with the asymptotic value of some field. And I just act on the vacuum and that gives me some other states. And I need to assume that I can formulate the theory in this space. So physically, this is the statement that I can formulate the theory in the space that's given by starting with the vacuum and then by throwing in matter from the boundary. Now, why is this a good assumption to make? You might say, you know, why is this a good assumption to make? And the reason this is a good assumption to make is because this Hilbert space is manifestly closed under time evolution. If I think of some state that was generated by throwing in stuff where these red lines are, and, you know, so the stuff goes and meets in the center and generates some complicated space, and I do a time translation, that time translation just shifts all of these lines up. And therefore, I get another state of the same kind, which is also generated by throwing stuff in from the boundary. And therefore, this Hilbert space is manifestly closed under time evolution. And so unitarity cannot force us to include additional states. Second, it's an interesting space because it's quite large. First of all, it includes all the low energy states I described previously that you get in low energy effective field theory, but it can also accommodate all black holes that are formed from collapse. Now, there might be other Hilbert spaces one could use to formulate the theory in anti-de Sitter space, but this is going to be the Hilbert space in which I'm going to work. And as I said, for these reasons, I think it's a good Hilbert space to work in. Okay. Now, if this is a Hilbert
Gaurav,
space...
You said that the energy is not assumed to be the Hamiltonian. So why yes. Is this closed under
there's some Hamiltonian in the theory, which is that Hamiltonian just shifts this value of T. So if I start with the vacuum and I have some state which looks like A of T zero, and I act on it with a unitary time translation, that just shifts the value of T, whatever the true Hamiltonian is, even if it's not the boundary operator. I'm just assuming that the true Hamiltonian, whatever it is, generates translations of this boundary time as well. for that reason, it's closed under time evolution. Does that answer the question?
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So now there's a simple result one can prove. The proof is in our paper, but I'll just explain what the argument is. You see, if one has a state of this kind that was created by acting with a boundary operator at some time in the vacuum, then if one looks at this matrix element, which is n and the boundary operator at some other time in zero, we know there's some value of t for which this matrix element is not zero because the state n was created by the action of a boundary operator at some point of time. So when this t hits that same time, there's some, you know, this matrix element clearly cannot be zero. But then if you assume that the full Hamiltonian of the theory, whatever the full Hamiltonian is positive, then you can show that this matrix element is analytic in the upper half t plane. And because it is analytic in the upper half t plane, you can show that this matrix element cannot vanish for t in any interval 0 to epsilon. If it vanished in any interval 0 to epsilon, it would vanish for all t, and that is not allowed because this n was created in this way. And therefore, this tells us that, you know, there is no state n which is orthogonal to all states that are created just by acting with boundary operators in the time interval 0 to epsilon on the vacuum. This is the statement that, in fact, the same Hilbert space that I generated by throwing in stuff at all values of time, which was on the left, you could, in fact, also generate by acting with operators in the time band 0 to epsilon on the vacuum. I do need a finite value of epsilon to apply this result from complex analysis. But for any finite value of epsilon, you could generate the same states, the same Hilbert space, by acting on the vacuum. This is also, by the way, a trivial example or a trivial consequence of the, or it's a trivial analog of the so-called Riesz-Lieder theorem. And sometimes when I describe this argument, people tend to worry a lot about it. And therefore, I want to demystify this result, the fact that you can squeeze this Hilbert space. And in fact, I want to point out that this is not a deep result. It's not a deep result in that this is a very simple analog of the following kind of result. You see, think of an EPR pair. Okay, so let's say we just have an EPR pair of two qubits and we put it in this space, which is A into 0, 0 plus B into 1, 1. Then it's a mathematical fact that if you look at operators that act on the first qubit, these operators acting on the first qubit generate a basis for the Hilbert space. In fact, these are Hermitian operators, but if you look at all operators on the first qubit, they generate for you any vector in the Hilbert space. So now there are two obvious points. First of all, this doesn't violate locality. It doesn't violate locality because, you know, clearly in quantum mechanics, you can take two qubits, put one on Earth, put the other in Mars. And the reason it doesn't violate locality is because physically one can only act with unitary operators. So this is a mathematical statement in that the application of the operators to the state generates all of these states in the vector space. But really, you know, we use the verb act, but you can really, in quantum mechanics, only act with unitary operators. So this is not a violation of locality. The second thing is that, you know, this fact doesn't say that by measuring anything in the first qubit, we actually generate any information about the second qubit. In particular, if you were to act with a unitary transformation on the second qubit, that unitary would commute with all observations one could make of the first qubit. So the statement I made here, which was in quantum field theory, that you could act with operators or apply operators on a small region near the boundary and generate all Hilbert space, generate the Hilbert space, is just a quantum field theory analog of this very trivial result in quantum mechanics. It utilizes the fact that in the vacuum, there's a lot of entanglement between different parts of space, and you can use that to generate the Hilbert space by applying operators from a small region to the vacuum. Okay? But in any case, you can prove it more formally, as I just described. Okay, so the fact, as I said, that applying boundary operators to zero generates the Hilbert space is something which is true in a local quantum field theory as well. In the argument I gave for this, there was no mention of gravity. And as I just explained, it doesn't violate locality, and also it gives no information about the bulk. It gives no information about the bulk by itself because in a local quantum field theory, there are unitaries in the middle that commute completely with operators that live near the edge. And so simply this fact on the left-hand side doesn't give any information on the about the bulk. But when one combines this fact on the left with the fact I mentioned earlier, which is that the vacuum can be identified from the boundary in gravity, which is the statement that the projector in the vacuum is an element of the boundary algebra. When one combines these two facts, one gets a very powerful result, which is that boundary operators contain all information in gravity. So I want to emphasize that without this second fact, which is true only in gravity, one cannot really prove this result or get anywhere. So let me try and prove, complete the argument. It's actually quite simple. So let O be any operator in the algebra of the theory, which lives in the Hilbert space. Because it's some operator, there's some expansion in a basis, in a complete basis of states. We can choose whatever basis of states we like, and I've just expanded this operator O in this basis of states. But now remember, every element in this basis has an expression of this form. It, you know, every state in this basis can be written as the application of a boundary operator on the vacuum. And that tells you that this operator O can be written in the first line, which is CNM into XN on ket 0, bra 0, and XM dagger. And that comes from the first result, which is that you could generate all states in the Hilbert space through these operators on the edge. But now in gravity, remember I told you in the beginning that this object in the middle, which is ket 0, bra 0, which is the projector in the vacuum, is an element of the boundary algebra. And therefore, what we have here is a linear combination of a product of three elements of the boundary algebra. The boundary algebra is closed because it's an algebra under products and linear combinations. And therefore, everything we see on the right-hand side is an element of the boundary algebra. And this tells us that all operators are elements of the boundary algebra. Therefore, clearly, any information that's available in the Cauchy slice in this Hilbert space, or any information in this Hilbert space, can be obtained by looking at an appropriate operator in the boundary algebra. So it's a very simple result, which follows just by putting together these two facts. The first fact, which is that all states in the Hilbert space arise from applying these boundary operators to the vacuum. And the second fact, which is that the projector on the vacuum is an element of the boundary algebra.
Sorry, can you, yeah. Okay, I think this is an important point that, as you were saying.
I couldn't hear, could you say again, please?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I'd like to understand that point a bit more, because Rishider, as you say, is some kind of trivial object. So of course, it's right. Some kind of trivial, you know, property of entanglement. But and as you say, in some sense, you know, if you have an operator in usual field theory, if you have an operator on the boundary, it commutes with an operator in the bulk. Right?
That's right.
So then you cannot determine the bulk from the
That's
boundary.
Right.
So here. Here, you're talking about two operators on the boundary, but could you be a bit more precise? And
it's the second step.
How an operator in the bulk is not commuting with...
It's because of this P0. You know, it's because of the fact that this P0 operator, this projector on the vacuum, there is no operator in the bulk that commutes with P0, because there's no operator which lives in the bulk which can map 0 back to itself. So there's no operator in the bulk which commutes with P0. So everything... All the magic came from going from the first line to the second line.
So there's no operator in the bulk that commutes with P0.
Right, because there's no operator that lives in the bulk that has.
Why is that true?
Because you see, the only operator that you'd need an operator that maps 0 back to itself. So that, you know, that. So if you take some operator in the bulk, it has some energy and it doesn't commute with P0. So it.
What if the vacuum is degenerate?
But the vacuum is not degenerating globally. So I will discuss in flat space a situation where the vacuum is degenerate.
Well, it depends on the choice of boundary conditions. I mean, there's an infinite set of boundary conditions.
In global ADS, if you choose normalizable boundary conditions, which is what I did, the vacuum is not degenerate.
Is that a proof, or is that an assumption, or is that what is?
Well, it's a low energy statement. If you quantize low energy effective field theory, you see a non-degenerate vacuum, and the assumption was that, you know, the full theory shares this low energy property. So indeed, I needed to make that assumption that the full theory shares this property of the low energy effective field theory. If you just quantize quantum fields about global ADS, you will see it as unique vacuum.
I think it really depends on the choice of boundary conditions. Honestly, you can relax.
The boundary condition I chose is.
Yeah, so you can choose very strong boundary conditions, like in flat space, where you know.
This is standard normalizable boundary conditions.
It's not necessarily a property of gravity, right? It's a property of the restriction on the boundary states. You could make that choice to restrict, but I think it's a very strong restriction from the quantum gravity perspective.
We can discuss flat space, right? We will have a degenerate vacuum. I think that, you know, the normalizable boundary conditions are well, at least in the ADS-CFT literature, there is standard. Well, you could frame everything in terms of normalizable boundary conditions. We can come to more the flat space case later, and what will happen with other boundary conditions. I think that this, you know, this kind of result I think would go through even in the case if you had a non-a degenerate vacuum, as we will discuss in the flat space case. So maybe we can discuss the degeneracy there. Here, I think the reason I did ADS in the beginning was precisely because, you know, it's a box and it allows me to not have to deal with this degeneracy of the vacuum. I will discuss that.
Well, I think, yeah, the definition of this box is really under question. I mean, I'm saying you're really careful about defining asymptotic ADS. You can see.
Indeed, but you know, this is a pretty interesting theory of quantum gravity already. I mean, the theory that you get by choosing normalizable boundary conditions, it has black holes, it has, you know, it has basically all the stuff that you would need. It even has, you know, if you take small enough black holes, it looks
It doesn't really have radiation. There is no radiation that's coming as to be
radiation. There's no radiation that goes far away. Indeed, that's true.
There's no radiation. So.
Indeed. If you accept this result, I'm happy to come to flat space where we'll discuss this. I will discuss flat space next.
Yeah. Let me just ask a question in this context itself.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a crucial statement you made, right, which was that this is supposed to be a vacuum, which presumably means it is annihilated by the physical Hamiltonian. What does vacuum mean for you?
Yes.
Then in all these theories, the physical Hamiltonian, in fact, is a bulk operator. There's no boundary term at all. I mean, for example, if you take the diffeomorphism constraint, I mean, the same thing is true, the Hamiltonian constraint is just not transparent, then the Hamiltonian operator is just a bulk integral of basically the derivative of the metric multiplied by the momentum.
That operator here. You see, this zero was, you're right, is the vacuum, but the assumption was that the energy, the numerical value of the energy is zero only for this vacuum.
Yeah, but so that's all. Clear.
That's all.
Classically, I think it has to do with these constraints being imposed, right? I mean, classically, this is not the. Okay, quantum mechanically, again, diffeomorphism constraint, I think we all more or less know how to take care of it. I mean, the issues. But then the diffeomorphism constraint, right? I mean, the statement is, if I just replace this thing,
yes,
then the statement is that the total Hamiltonian, which is going to be constraint plus a boundary term, is actually just a volume term. Term is just the derivative of the metric with respect to the vector field times the momentum operator. That's it is not. And therefore, it's not.
But I did not use the fact that the full Hamiltonian was a surface term. I used the fact that you could measure the energy from infinity. And there was an operator, which was the integrated metric, which could give you the energy. And all this P0 is the operator which projects onto the zero value for that energy. It's the value, you know, if you measure this energy, what's the probability that you get zero? It's given by the expectation of this operator P0.
Right, but except that you emphasized an answer to Laurel's question that there is no bulk operator which can select this. And I'm saying, in fact, that is selected by the bulk operator.
No. I didn't say there's no bulk. There is certainly a bulk operator which will also select this. You see, all information is certainly available in the bulk. The point is that there is a boundary operator which can select it, which is very special in gravity. In no other theory will a boundary operator select the vacuum for you. Of course, in gravity, there is also a bulk operator which will select the vacuum. I agree with. But
okay.
The point is there is also a boundary operator, which is this boundary energy, which can select the vacuum for you. And that's all I needed.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay.
Maybe to clarify the assumptions, my understanding about the assumptions that you're having is that, so in the bulk, you know, you're saying, I mean, it seems to me that what you're saying semi-classically is that if you have a solution of the constraints in the bulk, and then you fix your boundary condition to be completely reflexive and no radiation, then, of course, the knowledge of the boundary data, so you want to claim that there's a one-to-one correspondence between solutions of the constraints on any given slice and, you know, the boundary data that you're given.
Indeed. The statement is that if you look at solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and I tell you the boundary expectation values, and that's enough to fix the full solution. So in terms of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, that would be a statement. You take, if
even
you
semi-classically, I think your statement is, you know, should be true at the semi-classical level. Like,
I beg your pardon?
Solutions of the classical constraints, you want to say that this solution is completely determined by the value of the boundary metric, right?
I did not prove it in terms of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, but that would be analogous statement, that if you took the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and solved it, then the boundary data would determine the equations. I mean, I think we've actually made some progress towards proving that statement directly.
But yeah, the point is that nobody knows how to quantize the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, so it runs.
Yeah, in some simple cases.
That's why I'm trying to make a semi-classical statement that we can check, right? Because the main problem in quantum gravity is to define what we mean by the Wheeler-Levy equation.
Indeed. So the semi-classical state, yeah, it is indeed this. If you have substates in a physical Hilbert space, then by measuring these operators near the boundary, you could determine the full state.
Okay, just a quick clarification. So you are saying that there's a difference between pure classical theory and quantum theory.
This yes, I'm going to come to that actually. I will describe that in a minute, yes.
But you agree with this statement, right?
Yes, of course. I'll also say why in two slides from now, or maybe next slide. Okay, let me say a few things about the relevance of gravity, first of all. You see, it's clear that this kind of result is clearly false in a local quantum field theory in anti-de Sitter space. Even if I put the boundary conditions, which are normalizable boundary conditions, in a local quantum field theory, there are operators in the bulk that commute with all elements of the boundary algebra. You know, you could, if you had a gauge theory, for instance, you could just take a small Wilson loop, act on it in the middle of ADS, and it would commute with everything here. And so clearly, a non-gravitational theory, including a non-gravitational gauge theory, cannot have this property. And this is the property that's clearly special to a theory of gravity for reasons that we discussed, Second, as Abhay just asked, this is a property that's clearly also special to the quantum theory of gravity. In the classical theory, it is obviously true that one can specify initial data in the interior of a ball that's independent of data outside. I just think of this as Birkhoff's theorem if you think of this in spherically symmetric configurations. But you know, Corvino and Schoen showed this more rigorously for other kinds of configurations. And it's clear that in the classical theory, one can specify data inside without touching anything outside. And one intuitive way to understand that is that in the classical theory, one can measure the expectation value of the energy, which if you had some state or you had two states, you could measure in both states the expectation value of the energy. But in quantum mechanics, we get access to more. You get access to moments of the energy and quantum correlations of the energy with other operators. And the moments of the energy have no analog in the classical theory. And this, in a sense, is at the root of why you get more information in quantum mechanics than you do in classical mechanics. In fact, the moments of the energy for a spherically symmetric configuration will directly translate into the density distribution if you took a configuration of this kind that was spherically symmetric. And so both quantum mechanics and the fact that you're in a theory of gravity is important. Such a result is clearly false in a local quantum field theory, and it's clearly false in the classical theory.
Is that a classical analog? Is that a reformulation of Rich-Leader?
I beg your pardon?
Is that a reformulation of Rich-Leader? That's what you want to say?
This is not about Rich-Leader. I mean, I didn't understand.
Because Rich-Leader is the guy that tells you that you can...
Rich-Leader was important, but in what I said here, in the argument I'm giving here, it's the fact that in the classical theory, you can only measure the expectation value of H, and there's no sense in which you can measure moments of the energy. E squared or h squared is the same as expectation h squared. If you look at two states of this kind, one is a superposition of energy eigenstates, another is another superposition of energy eigenstates. I could very easily make the expectation of h the same by arranging some conspiracy between the AIs and the AI primes. But it's very hard for me to make the all moments the same unless I make mod of AI squared the same as mod of AI prime squared. In fact, you can distinguish the phases as well as I described. But I just want to point out here at this point, just this difference. And this is just arising from the fact that you can measure in gravity not only the energy, but also the moments of the energy. And there's no classical analog of that.
Well, there is a classical analog if you have a density distribution on the classical phase space.
Yes, then but there's nothing are not equal to each other. Of course, there's a classical analog.
You're looking at pure states, pure classical states and pure quantum states.
Of course, there is a classical analog in the bulk, but what I'm saying is that from the boundary, there's no sense in which you can measure a moment of the energy in the classical theory.
Well, you can if you have a mixed state, classically.
Oh, if you have a mixed state.
I have a classical phase space and I've got a mixed state, then I can measure the moments completely.
You could have some classical probability distribution over energies. But what I meant is, there is no notion of a quantum fluctuation in the energy, which is something which exists quantum mechanically. Of course, you're right. You could have some probability distribution over energy.
The general state in classical mechanics should be a distribution function of the phase space. And for the distribution function, this argument doesn't hold. but I think you're just restricting yourself to pure classical states and pure quantum states, and that's okay.
Okay, you're right. If I wanted to make an argument for mixed states, I'd have to explain how you separate quantum fluctuations from classical fluctuations, indeed. So this is, yes, but you're right. If you restrict yourself to pure states, then intuitively this explains why you would get more information. And you're right that you could think of classical states which have a probability distribution, you could have moments in that situation.
Because there's a large class of quantum states which for which predictions are the same as those in the classical.
Indeed. So I want to emphasize, of course, the argument I made was a more general argument. It would be able to distinguish mixed quantum states in the bulk from mixed quantum states. I was trying to give an intuitive explanation for why there's more data in the quantum theory. You're right, of course, you could. This is not accounting for the fact that quantum fluctuations may sometimes look like statistical fluctuations, and I have to be more careful to separate the two.
Exactly. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I agree. So this intuitive argument is not the complete story. I agree. Yes. Okay. Okay. Let me go on to asymptotically flat space. Since there are already questions about it. I'm going to go on next and try and establish the same kind of result in asymptotically flat space. I'll be a little fast because I went through many of the details in ADS as a warm up. So when I consider asymptotically flat space, I'll use the standard boundary conditions. So in particular, there's some Minkowski metric, and then there are deviations from the Minkowski metric that are subleading. I'm going to be very interested in the algebra of observables near a cut. So in particular, I want to think of the algebra of observables near a cut at some value u at future null infinity and u plus epsilon. This algebra for me is going to include the Bondi nus, which is the standard derivative of a component of the metric, the Bondi mass, and as usual in an algebra, all possible products and linear combinations of these operators. Okay? So this is just what one would call the standard definition of an algebra in the vicinity of a cut. I'm going to be particularly interested in the algebra near the past boundary of future null infinity, which I'll call a minus infinity. So if you see this notation, this is the algebra that lives near this orange cut right here. Every statement I make has an analog for past null infinity, but I'll just make the statements for future null infinity to avoid repeating myself. Okay, so now let me say a few things about what we understand of the Hilbert space of this theory. So the first thing we understand, as was already discussed, is that in flat space, unlike ADS, the vacuum is infinitely degenerate. And these infinitely degenerate vacua are, as far as we understand, and I'll speak of generalizations later, are, as far as we understand, labeled by different values of an infinite number of supertranslation charges. And on top of every such vacuum, which I label by S, which is given by all of these infinite number of supertranslation values, I can build a Fock space. And the Fock space is obtained as usual by just acting with the nus operators on these different vacua. And then one can speak of the full Hilbert space of massless particles, which is given by taking the direct sum of all of these infinite number of Fock spaces. So every statement I make in the rest of this flat space section is going to be confined to this space, which is the space of massless particles, because we don't yet know how to include massive excitations. I think we should be able to, and we've made some progress, but we've not completed. So for now, I'm going to restrict my statements to this space, which is the space of massless particles, obtained by taking these infinitely degenerate vacua and acting with the radiative fields on them.
But you're adding one observable, right, which is not contained in the radiative things, which is the
Bondi mass
transparency. You add this, the mass aspect.
The Bondi, yes, indeed. Because I think the Bondi mass is a physical observable.
But is it a mass only or the whole aspect? I mean, are you're just looking at the integral on the whole cross-section, or you're looking at
To later use all the supertranslation charges, which are going to use the Bondi mass aspect and integrate them with different kinds of functions. Okay.
So you're giving yourself also this Bondi mass aspect, which is not part of the radiative phase space. This is an additional.
It's not part of the radiative phase space, but it is an observable in the sense that, it's a component of the metric. So if you measure the Riemann tensor far away, then you would also be able to extract this Bondi mass aspect.
Right, but it's not included in the observables, the nus observable. So it is really an addition. So therefore, your Hilbert space, if you just started out of the vacuum state, for example.
It maps the Hilbert space back to itself in that you get this radiative, of course, you get this Hilbert space and it's an operator on the Hilbert space. But it's important that we include it because I think it is an observable in the sense that, we measure the metric or we measure the mass of objects by going far away. If you throw away this constraint, then indeed, you would lose a lot of the information that I'm going to get.
To clarify, because it's an important.
Yes,
this is like the Coulombic aspect up here, which is not captured by the CAB that you got up here. This is something additional up here. This M of U is not captured by CAB.
This M of U is not captured by CAB. That's right.
Therefore,
this M of U is not,
when you look at the Hilbert space,
yes,
there must be something in the Hilbert space which also has information of MBF, U and omega.
You could set it, if you set, for instance, the mass to be zero at infinity, it's just an integral of MB, it's just an integral of N squared. So, you know, you could set the mass by using the constraints and by solving the constraints. I mean,
are you doing that? I mean, that's the key point that
No, for me, it's just an autonomous observable, because I'm thinking of observers who really live near the boundary and who really physically measure a component of the matrix.
But the thing is that the Hilbert space that you just constructed on the next slide, which is supposed to be obtaining from this vacuum by acting on it repeatedly by, you know, the supertranslated vacuum, you say it up here.
Yes.
That supertranslated vacuum does not have information about the mass itself. The mass aspect itself, right?
Well, in that, if you, you know, what I'm going to need is that when you act on it with a super translation charge, this is the first equation. I mean, this you could think of as the mass aspect at u goes to minus infinity, which is what I'm going to need. So what I'm going to need is that, you know, when I speak of the algebra of observables, I'm going to assume that this super translation charge is also an observable, and that you can really measure the super translation charge. I think that's a good assumption, because I think you could, you know, it's one component of the Riemann tensor. You know, when we quantize the theory, there's a sense in which we divide up constraints and we take some physical set of observables, which is the radiative data, and then we generate a phase space. But, you know, physically, if you're far away, if you measure the mass of the sun or measure the mass of some object, the mass is an observable, which is as much of an observable as another component of the metric. So the fact that we choose to quantize things in terms of the news and not keep M is a matter of convenience and quantization, but I think for an observer who is at some value of U, it's as much of an observable. I mean, that would be the position I would take. The mass is an observable, or the energy is an observable.
Okay, so but I guess I have to just understand a little bit more about what this S is again. S is supposed
this
to
S
be
a state, is just right? A vacuum. This S is a vacuum which has these values for the different super translation charges.
But the point is that super translation charges measured where?
At minus infinity.
At minus infinity only.
Yes.
Okay.
So the full super translation charge, not the hard. I am not dividing anything into hard or soft here.
Okay, that's very good. Okay, thank you.
Okay. So now the result I want to establish is that if you define the algebra in this way, including the mass, including measurements of the mass, which I think is important because they're components of the metric, then I'm going to try and argue that any two distinct states in this Hilbert space that I described can be distinguished just by observables in A minus infinity, which is near this little cut here. Okay. So in fact, the argument is very similar to ADS, and I'm going to make the argument now. So the first statement is that, you know,
just one question. So, yes. I mean, this little interval that you're talking about, minus infinity to epsilon, is actually infinite.
A big interval.
It's not a little neighborhood, because it's really semi-infinite.
Yes, it's a big interval. You're right.
It's a semi-infinite interval. Okay, so I think that's important.
In the conformal diagram, it looks little. You're right. It's a big interval in some sense. It has an infinite amount of retarded time.
Right, it's infinite. It's semi-infinite.
That was also true in ADS, because I was talking about the region from R0 to infinity. So in some sense, there was an infinite amount of data, you know, from R0 to infinity, the infinite amount of volume from R0 to infinity. That's important, actually, to damp out fluctuations and make sure I can measure these Hamiltonians and so on accurately. But, you know, the point is that in a local quantum field theory, there would be a lot of data that would be living on these other parts of Scribe Plus. And I'm trying to argue that all the data you can get from here. Maybe little is a bit of a misnomer, because it's little on the Penrose diagram, but it's not little in some real sense. You're right. It's infinite in some other sense.
It's semi-infinite. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. So the first statement is that, you know, this by using the same kinds of arguments, I won't go through it in detail, but we did it in detail in our paper. Using the same kind of argument I made for ADS, you can argue that, in fact, any state in each of these Fock spaces can be generated by acting with news operators, not just on all of Scribe Plus, but by acting with news operators in this little or this u minus infinity to minus 1 over epsilon region on each of these vacuums. And this argument is exactly the same, so I won't go through it, but you can squeeze the Hilbert space down just as I described. Okay. The second thing is that as we discussed, both the Hamiltonian and super translation charges are in what I call this algebra at A minus infinity. Both the Hamiltonian and super translation charges are obtained by taking the metric and integrating them with different kinds of functions. And because they are in A minus infinity, I want to point out that all the projectors, all the spectral projectors of these operators are also in this boundary algebra. They're physically in the boundary algebra, because in quantum mechanics, if you were to measure one of these charges, There's some probability of getting an answer between S and S plus delta S, and that probability is given by taking one of these spectral projectors and looking at its expectation value in the state G. Therefore, these spectral projectors, and in fact, the projector onto the manifold of vacua, which is now the analog of P0, which in ADS was just projecting onto one state, but now projects onto this large manifold of vacua, all these projectors are in A minus infinity. Okay. Then, as a result, because these projectors onto supertranslation charges and also this projector onto the vacuum, onto the manifold of vacua live in A minus infinity, I can multiply two of these projectors, which both live in the algebra, and I can get this operator, which is, you know, ket S bra S, and this operator also lives in A minus infinity. I haven't been careful to regularize these vacua. You may need to integrate them with smooth functions. So right now they're delta function regularized, but if you allow me that sloppiness, then this operator also lives in A minus infinity. So we once again find that in flat space as an anti de Sitter space, even though there's an infinite degeneracy in the vacuum, a specific vacuum can be selected using observables from the boundary of the spacetime. And this is a very unique feature of gravity. And the second thing I need to say, which is that using these projectors and using, in fact, simple operators that we can write on explicitly, once you have these projectors onto the vacua, you can also construct transition elements onto the vacua because you act on one of these vacuum with some operator you excited and you project back down to the vacuum and you'll get a transition element between these different vacua. And this is also an element of this algebra A minus infinity.
Sorry, can you just repeat again why you get a unique vacuum? I mean, you have got this infinite vacuum degeneracy.
No, I had infinite vacuum, but I multiply these to get a projector onto a unique vacuum. There are still all those vacua, but this operator, which is ket S bra S, which clicks for one vacuum and doesn't click for the others, lives in the boundary algebra. That's all I want to say. So it says one can select a specific vacuum using observables means that I can write down an observable that gives you one if you're in one vacuum and gives you zero in the other vacuum.
Okay, but I can choose another observable which will give me another vacuum.
Indeed, absolutely. All those observables live in the algebra. Yeah. That's right. Okay, so now, in fact, the argument is very similar to the argument I made in ADS. You see, let's take any operator in the theory, any operator that maps the space of massless particles back to itself. You can expand it in this Fock space. So what can it do? It can map one state in the Fock space to another state in the same Fock space in the same vacuum, or it can map you from a Fock space about one vacuum to a Fock space about a different vacuum. So you have this sum over different elements in the Fock space and also over different vacua. But now notice by the argument I made, each of these states in the Fock space can be obtained by acting with an operator from the algebra on one of these vacua. Okay? And so we have this second line. But I also pointed out that these transition elements between one vacuum and another vacuum lived in this boundary algebra. And so once again, on the right-hand side, we have a linear combination of a product of three elements of the boundary algebra. And the right-hand side is therefore manifestly in the boundary algebra. And this therefore, in a way that's very similar to ADS, but now involves these infinitely degenerate vacua, shows that any operator which maps the Hilbert space of massless particles back to itself can in fact be obtained very as accurately as one likes by an operator near the past boundary of future null infinity. And this is the precise version of the statement that you can obtain all information from the past boundary of future null infinity.
Can I, just to make sure I understand, so the reason you can restrict to the, you know, this A epsilon of the past is again...
Sorry, I'm not able to hear, please. I don't know what...
So can you hear me?
Yeah. I mean, I'll try and fix my volume maybe, yeah.
So the reason you can restrict to this small region A minus infinity epsilon, if I understand properly, is again due to this Riesch-Lieder argument, right?
No. The Riesch-Lieder argument would not have helped you at all unless you had the...
So how do you... Okay, what is the... That's what I'm confused about. So usually the data is... You need the data on all of null infinity, okay?
It's in going from the...
What is your argument that restricts...
It's in going from the second to the third line. I want to emphasize once again that the Riesch-Lieder was kind of the trivial part. The Riesch-Lieder took us from the first to the second line. So the Riesch-Lieder is very trivial, and I really wanted to demystify that. The Riesch-Lieder holds in any local quantum field theory, and it's going from the first to the second.
Yeah, but it seems that's the key argument you're using to...
No. The key is going from the second to the third.
I'm not sure what the first line or the second line contains. So what... So in the first line, we have operators that are defined on the entire...
The first line is operators on the full space. The second line tells you can generate all these operators by acting with elements in a small region on one of these vacua.
That's Riesch-Lieder.
And that's true in any local quantum field theory as well.
Yes.
So up to this line where my mouse is, it's true in any local quantum field theory. The thing that's not true in any local quantum field theory is that this operator, which is ket s bra s prime, which is what I call ts s prime, is not an element of the boundary algebra in any local quantum field theory. The fact that one can select the vacuum that this projector onto, or this transition element between one vacuum to another vacuum, is also available on the boundary is a unique feature of gravity. That's what causes this operator to not commute with something in the bulk. So this second line so far is true where my mouse is, if you can see, is true in any local quantum field theory. Going from here to here is the argument I made about, you know, how you're able to project using the super translation charges onto this vacuum, and then you're able to write down these transition operators. And this is only true in gravity. So going from the second to the third line was what was true in gravity, and that's where all the information came from.
It's clear. So now about the last point, I think it goes back to what Abhay was saying. So so I agree that if you say that n minus infinity, that is the mass aspect at minus infinity, is in your algebra A minus infinity, then you can do that. Now, because of the Gauss law, conservation law of mass along null infinity, you could also, and because of the fact that we know that all the mass aspect is distilled at plus infinity, so we know that n plus infinity is zero, you know, then we can write n minus infinity as an integral over a scribe plus of operators. So there is something, you know, strange going on, that when you promote n minus infinity as being part of this localized algebra, it's also an operator which is completely delocalized on scribe plus.
Indeed, but you see, but
which is fine with me. Maybe you say I want to include these guys, but it's maybe a matter of language when you say that this operator is completely localized.
It's localized in a physical sense, in that, you know, gravity does this for you automatically. I mean, when we measure the mass of the sun, we don't say we are measuring a non-local operator. We just measure the metric as it is here, and how the metric is modified by the sun, or, you know, how the metric near Venus is modified by the mass of the sun. So gravity does this for, you know, nature does this for us automatically, in that we just need to measure the metric at some point, and nature has worked out the constraints. So indeed, all this is true on a solution of the constraints, and to solve the constraints, you know, you need to, on a computer, you may need to do lots of complicated things. But in the end, there's an operator which you measure, which is the metric at some point, and that already, you know, contains all this information. So when we measure the charge or we measure the mass, you know, in some sense, you're right, it's equated to a volume integral by
I'm trying to help you. I mean, there's no notion of local operator in quantum gravity. That's what I'm saying. So it doesn't make any sense to say that a physical operator is localized, and then that mass formula, n minus infinity being delocalized along all of sky plus, is the prime example of such a formula. In some sense, you know, that's where holography comes from. There's the non-locality of every physical observer, you could say.
I agree that, yeah. Sure.
Anyway, but because it's kind of confusing for people, you know, you can think of n minus as a localized, I understand, as if you look at the metric, you're saying it's a localized operator, but you could also think equally true as a completely delocalized one. And
I agree.
And I'm honestly,
I want to disagree, and therefore I would like to sort of pinpoint the, I think this is what Laura might have been getting at, but no, I think it's not delocalized, because if you just know the Hilbert, the news, for example, I mean, let's understand for the classical theory.
By delocalized, I mean as an integral over
square. I don't know, but that, right, right. But I think what he's saying is that all the information is contained in the semi-infinite interval, minus infinity to epsilon. That is the key statement that is being made because of various things. But in classical theory, this is not true. And you would also agree. So what, because in classical theory, I can just specify the news anywhere I want to the future of epsilon.
Absolutely.
And therefore, the operator in the future infinity is not determined by what is happening in this local region. So I think, on the other hand, you would agree that there should be some sense in which I should recover classical theory from the formal calculations I'm doing in quantum theory. But I'm missing out kind of a blatant feature. There's infinite freedom I got in the classical theory, which is just disappearing. So how could it reappear in the classical limit? So why am I not doing something which has nothing to do with the classical general relativity?
I think it's because what I said, that in the classical limit, there's no sense in which one can look at correlation functions of the Hamiltonian or super translation charges with other operators.
No, but
there's the mixed state, but if we leave aside the probability distribution in a pure state, there's no sense in which, you know, Q and O or Q and some other operator is just the product of the expectation value.
Okay. So supposing I give you a classical news function, okay?
Right.
And you just restrict myself to the minus infinity to epsilon interval. And supposing it even goes to zero at epsilon, okay?
Yes.
Then you, in the quantum theory, you will have some state,
yes,
including this mass operator, the,
yes,
minus infinity, the Bondi, yes, Bondi aspect operator.
Yes.
So you'll have some state up there, right? Okay. And so you're going to get this state and you've got all such states also, right?
Yes.
But now you produce for me from this state, right? I mean, what the evolution is, presumably. You'll tell me what happens to the future.
Yes. Yes.
But now I give you a classical state, which is really arbitrary Bondi news to the future of 100 times epsilon. So it coincided with your previous thing. Up to epsilon, but now
I can say a little bit more about, you know, there is in the paper we have, actually I didn't put in the flat space example. In the paper we have, there's a specific 2-point correlation function one can measure, which is the correlation function of the Bondi mass and the Bondi news itself inserted in the semi-infinite interval. So this 2-point function of m and n already contains information about you know this Bondi news which is going to come and hit us in the future.
I got infinitely many states.
Indeed.
Infinitely many classical states.
Yes.
Which will all agree in your interval.
Yes. And we can, in fact, reconstruct. So for instance,
if you consider
the state which was n of u into f of u. So act with a unitary, which is e to the I, n of u smeared with f of u, where f of u has support only beyond u equal to 10,000, for instance. So this is, in fact, we have this specific example in the paper, although I didn't put it in the talk. So do you see, it's a shock wave which is coming and hitting you to some future, and the infinite amount of freedom you have is in the profile of the shock wave.
But your algebra does not have n of u to the future. Your algebra, the whole point I thought was that you...
No, but we could think of a state which was e to the I n of u. Maybe if I share screens from the... If you could hold on the question a little bit, I'll come back to a physical protocol of EDS, and then we can discuss this again.
That sounds good. Yeah,
I should have put in the news example, which I didn't, but I have an EDS example.
Okay, but I mean, I'd like to come back. But this, to me, this is the key obstacle.
Yeah, sure. I'll come back to this.
Thank you.
Okay. So I'm running a little short of time. I should say that the argument I made in some sense was an argument in semi-classical theory. Sometimes people say, how do you know in the full theory, you know, only there are only super translations and not other charges? And there could be, but the argument I made would still go through, provided vacua and the full theory are still labeled by operators near the past boundary of future null infinity, and these low energy operators that map the space of vacua back to itself are still contained in A minus infinity. So provided the full theory shares some low energy properties of the semi-classical theory, this property would still be true in the full theory. Okay, so I had some slightly more detailed arguments, but I won't go through them. Let me just mention there's a slightly more detailed result, which is, you can actually get information, if you make slightly stronger assumptions, information to the future of any cut can be obtained by looking at the algebra of a cut. So far I was making an argument near the edges of null infinity, but in fact, you could try and push that argument up in flat space, but I won't mention it now because I'm running short of time. So let me just go skip this part and come, in fact, to the perturbative verification, which is the question that Abhay asked. I unfortunately put this in EDS, although I could have put it in flats. I could have said some things in flat space. But let me try now maybe ask, which is related to some of the questions that people have. How does one verify this? This looks like some theorem I proved in operator algebras. And how does one verify that this is really true within perturbation theory if you have some observables? The setup I want to consider is where we have ADS. I'm going to go back to ADS. And I have some observers who live on this brown time band. And they're allowed to do the following things. So I'm back in ADS. So there are no super translations, but they're allowed to make projective measurements of the energy. And they're allowed to act with little unitaries in this little time band here. So, they can make excitations of this kind. And of course, they have access to identically prepared systems, so they can reliably determine probabilities. And now I want to explain how we can convert the previous argument I had into a physical protocol for these observers near the boundary to obtain information about the bug. I want to emphasize that these powers I'm giving these observers who live near the boundary, which is the power to act with low energy unitaries and to make projective measurements in the region they're in, are completely standard. They're what I teach when I teach the quantum mechanics course. So there's nothing controversial here. All I'm saying is, we act with unitaries, make projective measurements, and determine how much information you can get. Okay. So let's first ask the following question, which is kind of a very simple question, which is let's put the observers in some state G and let's ask them to determine if they're in the vacuum or if they're in some other state which is not the vacuum. So they're just asked to determine if G is zero, if the state, this G, the world that they live in is zero or if it's not zero. So if it's a vacuum or if it's some excited state here, which is not the vacuum. And in fact, in a local quantum field theory, this is clearly impossible. It's impossible because these observers cannot distinguish the vacuum from some unitary bulk operator that acts in the middle and commutes with every measurement they can do. So these observers who are confined, unfortunately, to make measurements in this brown annular region cannot distinguish the vacuum from this other state. And this is an impossible task in a local quantum field theory. But in gravity, it's a very simple task because they just measure the this energy. And the moment they measure the energy by the bond rule, they can get different kinds of answers. And because they have identically prepared systems, they just determine the probability distribution with which they get zero. And this probability distribution directly tells them the overlap of the global state with the vacuum. And therefore, it successfully distinguishes between the vacuum and some other state which is orthogonal to the vacuum. And this is a very physical thing these observers far away can do to get information about the bulk, to distinguish this state from this state, which was impossible in a local quantum field theory. Now you might say, you know, that's kind of cheating because the vacuum is uniquely identified by the energy. Even in a classical theory, if I tell you the energy is zero, then I completely fixed everything in the bulk. And so maybe, you know, this was too simple a task. So in fact, we can give the observers a harder task. And the harder task is as follows. Let's say they happen to be in a state G. Just to make the algebra simple, I'm going to assume that this state G is orthogonal to the vacuum to start with. So it's not the previous case we considered. Now it's some other state G, which is orthogonal to the vacuum. It could have been created by acting with some operator here. Okay. But as we discussed, there is some simple Hermitian operator from this time band or from this region, which when applied to the vacuum generates the same state. And now I'm asking the observers to determine if this state G they live in is this state X or if it's some other state. So once again, these states could have the same energy. So, you know, one of them could have a red ball with some energy, the other could have a blue ball with the same energy, the same expectation value of the energy. And the observers are asked to determine if these two, you know, if the state G they live in is the state with the red ball or if it's not. So in fact, again, it's impossible in local quantum field theory. But in fact, there's a very physical thing these observers can do to determine or to complete this task in gravity using the powers that they have. And that's the following. They first act with a unitary, which is e to the ijx, where x was this operator we discussed previously. Of course, you can't act with a Hermitian operator, but you can act with a unitary operator. This action of a unitary modifies the state from g to ug, where g is this, where this modified state is, I've written up to second order in j. After making this manipulation, they then measure the energy to second order in J. It's a very simple calculation, but measuring this energy to second order in J directly gives them the overlap of G and the desired state X. So through this physical process, which is making a unitary transformation and then measuring the energy, they can directly determine the overlap of G with the state X. Maybe at this point, I can also pause to explain, answer Abhay's question. So Abhay was asking, you know, what if you had in ADS language, if you didn't have, you could have said, what if you acted with some operator in ADS, which was going to come and hit the ADS boundary at a later time? So you can have such operators, you can create an excitation in the middle of ADS, which is going to come and hit the boundary at a later time. How would you determine what that excitation was? And the important thing here is that we measure We have this notion of measuring of acting with unitary manipulation and then measuring the energy. And that is the same as measuring correlation functions of the Hamiltonian with other Hermitian operators. And these correlation functions do contain all the information that's required to reconstruct the state in the bulk, even though in the classical theory, the correlation function would factorize in a pure state and would not give you the information that one needed. Let me skip this part. We were able to show in this recent paper, so there are details in this paper we wrote last month, that in fact, by extending the simple protocol I just described, you could in fact identify these near low energy observers, could identify any low energy state in ADS. So this, at this point in this paper, is a completely perturbative protocol in a completely controlled setting doesn't even use any operator algebra language or any results, but just uses very standard quantum mechanics results. And if you give these observers near the boundary these powers to act with these unitaries and measure the energy, that is sufficient for them to identify any low energy state. And of course, you have to make these extrapolations if you wanted to make the argument for the full theory. But in the low energy theory, you can really completely verify this in perturbation theory. Okay, maybe I'll take 5 minutes more and say a little bit about black holes, and then we can come back to questions. I'll try and be brief. So one often asks, I think these arguments I've been describing give us some perspective on black hole information. I think one often asks the question of how does information come out of the black hole as it evaporates. So if you drew a Penrose diagram, that's the question of, you know, how, if you took this green slice which collects a lot of the Hawking radiation, could you get information about this brown dust that collapsed to form the black hole? But the result I've been describing suggests that in a sense the information is always outside, and you could even get it from this red slice by making measurements even before evaporation. Now there's a slightly formal way one can state that, and the formal way one can state that is in terms of the von Neumann entropy on Scry Plus. So it's common, in fact, to define a state on Scry Plus by asking it to be that element of the algebra on Scry Plus, which when traced with some observable gives you the expectation value of the observable. This is just the way you would define a density matrix. But using the results I just explained, because you could always choose an element of this algebra to be some element from this boundary algebra, the result I described previously told us that all elements, all operators that lived in null infinity could be written, had a representative that lived in the semi-infinite interval from minus infinity to epsilon. Because one can always choose this density matrix to come from this interval, it tells us that if one computes this von Neumann entropy is independent of u, because you can always choose the density matrix to be some fixed operator from this interval a minus infinity. And that tells us that if you define the von Neumann entropy in this way, then the von Neumann entropy will just be flat as you define the state and you took it from u equal to minus infinity up to u equal to plus infinity. And that is the formal version of the statement that the information is always outside. Now, of course, we are all familiar with a conventional page curve that tends to go up and come down. And one question people ask is, you know, why does the conventional page curve fail? I think the conventional page curve fails because it is based on known to be incorrect assumptions about the factorization of the Hilbert space when you take the boundary algebra to include also these physical observables like the mass. I want to emphasize here, since we already had some discussion, that if you were to restrict the algebra and throw out the mass aspect from the algebra, then subject to certain assumptions one could make about how much information is in the soft charges, it could be the case that that algebra would give you the conventional page curve. But the physically important point I wanted to make here, which is really the point I wanted to make through this flat curve, is that if you include the mass in the set of observables, then the information is always available outside the black hole, in the sense that if you include the mass in the set of observables, then the von Neumann entropy stays flat. And that's the physically important point, not the question of whether some appropriate restriction of the algebra yields the page curve, which I think it might, but I think the physical point is unchanged by that. Okay, maybe I should also quickly mention, since there's been a lot of discussion in ADS-CFT on a derivation of the page curve, you know, there's been a lot of recent work on deriving the page curve in ADS, but a lot of that work, which is very nice, considers ADS black holes that are coupled to a non-gravitational bath. When one takes a black hole of this kind, which is some system which could have a description in terms of a completely non-gravitational theory, and couples it to a bath, per force, by construction, one has a factorization of the Hilbert space. And therefore, it's clear that both the black hole, or you know, what one is calling the black hole, which is really the black hole plus the full system here, and both the entropy of the bath follow the conventional page curve. And that has to happen because in this construction, we have a factorization of the Hilbert space. But the problem is that the way these calculations are done morally is that in some sense, there's a black hole, and then there's ADS, and then there's a region with no gravity, which is this red region here. And this region, you know, this kind of calculation does indeed, you know, follow a page curve where information emerges gradually. But I think the important physical point is that this kind of setup, a model which has a black hole and gravity, and then at some point gravity just switches off, is not the same as a black hole in our world where you have weak gravity that goes all the way out to infinity. And I think it's important because weak effects in gravity can conspire to give radically different answers from local quantum field theories, as I've been arguing. And as in fact also appears in these calculations themselves. So I think that in systems where gravity is non-dynamical beyond some region, which is the systems which have been considered a lot recently, the information may indeed emerge according to the Page curve. But for more realistic black holes, the information is always outside, as I've been trying to argue. Okay, so I already went over time. Let me just conclude with this slide. The main point I wanted to make is that if you take some region and you have the complement of the region, which also includes infinity, then there's a sense in which a copy of the information inside the region is also available outside, which is very different from local quantum field theories. In local quantum field theories, if you had an observer here, the observer could not tell whether there was this yellow excitation inside the region or not without actually visiting the region. But in gravity, the observer can tell whether the excitation exists or not by making these quantum gravity kinds of measurements. I want to emphasize that this is not an abstract subtlety. I went through it a little fast because I was running out of time, but in this paper, we described a very concrete physical protocol whereby observers who live here can actually extract information at low energy in ADS by making physical unitary manipulations and measurements of the energy. And I think this provides a new perspective on black hole information, because it suggests that the correct way we should think about black holes is that the exterior always retains a copy of what fell inside. So I'll stop here, and sorry for going over time. Thank you for listening.
All right, let's thank Subrat. So we have a very short time for questions now, 5 minutes at most. So please try to ask very important questions only if you...
So I have a very, very important question.
Yes.
Where was this massless? I think I missed that. Why was the massless part important? And is it just for flat space or for ADS as well?
It was not important for ADS, but it was important in flat space. It was important in flat space because, you know, the massive particles are really defined at future infinity or past infinity, future time-like or past time-like infinity. So I didn't have a good, you know, if you tried, there's no good way I know to describe massive particles as you go towards the past boundary of future null infinity. You know, in everything I said, it was important that I had not only the Hamiltonian, but I could measure correlation functions of the Hamiltonian with other dynamical fields. And these dynamical fields just don't, for massive particles, don't exist in any simple way as you go to null infinity and its past boundary. And now that's a complication one might be able to go beyond. I mean, Madolf has done some work on this, and maybe one can thicken null infinity appropriately to also describe massive particles as some limit. But we don't know how to do that. In ADS, that's not a complication because massive particles, there's a good sense in which massive fields also go out to the time-like boundary.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
There's some people other than me and Abai asking questions. I have questions, I'm sure Abai still have questions.
But... Yeah, I do, but I think we can wait here.
Yeah.
I mean, we can arrange like another meeting eventually.
But who else has questions?
So Subrat is available, like during the group meeting, maybe a slot, we can arrange a follow-up of the seminar. But maybe for now,
I'd be happy to, I'd be happy to.
Okay, so if someone else in the audience wants to ask some question now, just a couple of minutes left.
Could I ask about this concept of the localized initial data? Are you saying, I was just wanted a clarification, like this measurement protocol you're saying in the quantum theory would be able to measure that? And do you have some intuition of, is there any classical analog of that at all? Or is it completely just not available in the classical theory? Or is there something you can, is it a completely non-perturbative effect or what?
It's a completely perturbative effect. It's not non-perturbative at all. But you're right, there's no classical analog in that the effect is proportional to edge bar. I mean,
it would show up in Poisson brackets or something like that.
This effect would just go away in the if you took the limit where you took edge bar to zero. So that this effect is, these fluctuations I'm determining are, you see, I'm trying to measure the quantum fluctuations of the metric far away. And I'm trying to get from the quantum fluctuations of the metric this information in the bulk. And these fluctuations would just go away if you took the classical limit. So there's no classical analog. On the other hand, this is not a non-perturbative effect in that, you know, you can compute these fluctuations reliably within perturbation theory. So in this physical protocol we described in this paper, completely perturbative. But it's still quantum mechanical. It's not classical.
I think what Anthony is saying is that sometimes when you say it's not classical, it depends how you frame classical. That is, what Andy is suggesting is that if the what you allow as classical operation is exponentiating or recurrent Poisson bracket copy, then you might be able to do exactly the same thing. As long as you can include the Poisson bracket in your algebra, then you can access deeper correlation. So
Jacobson,
the sense that powers of the Poisson bracket are proportional to each bar.
I want to emphasize, I didn't try and, you know, this was indeed the way Marov made his argument by looking at e to the iht as a time evolution operator and, you know, looking at commutators as repeated Poisson brackets. But I tried to stay away from that argument, and that's why I tried to emphasize physically this measurement of the energy and quantum fluctuations of the energy. In fact, you know, it's clear in the classical theory this kind of thing will fail and that the information is not available outside. Because you can clearly, just in a spherically symmetric setup, have two configurations which are identical in the interior and which are identical in the exterior and differ in the interior. So it's clear the argument does not hold classically. So, you know, you're right, if one phrases it in terms of exponentiated Poisson brackets, it may seem confusing, but it's clear that there is no classical.
I mean, it would be nice to see, maybe that's, I mean, for me, this is the discussion I want to see.
It would be nice to see, I mean, we can discuss more how this classical issue.
How do we recover NU, you know, without exponentiating the Poisson bracket?
So mathematically, I think it's clear in that, you know, this information, this physical protocol is like measuring, as I said, correlations functions of fluctuations of the Hamiltonian with other operators, and those fluctuations just don't exist in the classical theory.
If you have a statistical, if you in the classical theory on the phase space, if you don't look at pure states, but if you look at density matrices, then there are these fluctuations, and then I think what Laurent says can actually be done, and you know, you can encode now. For some cases, I think, as you say, we should discuss this later. I mean, the point is that there is especially at SCRI, at the asymptotically flat case, you could actually show that.
We just need a counterexample in the classical case, because all we need is, let's take two stars. One is a dilute star and one is a dense star. And that's just one state. Say there's no probability distribution. With probability one, we're in that state. Then the Hamiltonian outside is the same, and there's no way from outside we would get information about the density of the star.
That's the difference, right? I mean, you're saying that, I'm saying that from the perspective of infinity, I should consider as the density matrix. And there exists a density matrix such that it actually accommodates all the correlations that are there.
Maybe your question is, I think maybe one could phrase your question the following way, in that once I measure these fluctuations of the Hamiltonian in the quantum case, I would still need to be careful that they're really coming from, you know, it's not a mixed state. So maybe you could say that I have to be careful that I'm not looking at a mixed state, but I'm really looking at a pure state with a given. And that we are careful about. So we can distinguish these kinds of mixed states from pure states in this full protocol that we have.
Okay, we can discuss later. Because
I think we have to wrap it up now, and we can continue this in another place. But for the moment, let's thank Sovrat again.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.